Today's show has been brought to you by Brooklyn Slate Company, manufacturer of slate cheese boards, coasters, and other fine items. Check them out at www.brooklynslate.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good morning. You're listening to In the Drink on heritageradionetwork.org. I'm your host, Joe Campanelli, and I am here with my friend Jordan Salcido. Jordan is the head of beverage operations for the Momofuku Group. She has an incredible wine label called Bellis that we have at our various restaurants, definitely at Dell'Anima, at Lartuzzi. I believe at La Picho as well. We carry the Bellis, the Tuscan, Super Tuscan. It's absolutely delicious. With the proceeds, a portion of the proceeds going to the Tory Burch Foundation. Jordan is also a partner in the Charlie Bird restaurant. Congratulations. And involved also in the Castanova della Cervaie kind of has made wine at the Brunello estate in Montalcino. So Jordan, you have your hands very, very full, very busy. I'm really excited that you've carved out some time to chat with us this morning.
It's such an honor to be here. Thank you so much for having me on the show.
Really, really great to have you. I mean, I guess first and foremost, congratulations on the new position, relatively new position at Momofuku. I mean, that I just had a killer meal at Samba. I've been going for years and years. I used to live pretty much across the street, and Sam and Noodle have been some of my favorite restaurants, and I've gone less frequently, but to my own shame, less frequently to both Ma Pesh and to Co. Tell us a little bit about what you have going on, what you're excited about, and about this new position.
Okay. It's a really, really fun group to work with. And all the restaurants are so different. So they each have their own personality. And that is the aspect that's one of the aspects that's the most fun about working there, because you have these very different spaces with very different things to say. So I've been spending a lot of time on the program at Ma Pesh recently. And we actually, last night was sort of the inauguration of this new short rib dinner that is available. So we had two groups come in for the short rib dinner, and it's a tableside dinner, and the star of the meal is this tableside carved short rib, but there are lots of other goodies along the way. And the point is that it's beautiful and it's delicious, but it's also great with wine. And Ma Pesh has an amazing, I guess it has an amazing cellar in terms of, like, the actual space is awesome, and it's such a rarity in New York, but also, you know, in relation to the East Village, where everything is so small and compact and you're sort of finding space everywhere for everything. Midtown is big, and the space at Ma Pesh, it's a large, beautiful, open space, and the cellar is the same. So
So it's fair to say that you can do things on a larger scale. You can have more wines there. Yes. You can have large format dinners.
Exactly.
It's not as cramped. Maybe a little bit easier to get a reservation.
Exactly. Which is really fun. So we're in the process of expanding the list right now. So actually, I mean, the list for the next couple of weeks is still it's still very compact, but we're expanding it. So we have a lot of fun stuff in the cellar that's not on the list yet. What do we have in-house? I guess the other thing that we're doing in Midtown that doesn't really make sense at the downtown restaurants is really expanding the selection of benchmarks that we offer. Mm-hmm. So Bordeaux, Burgundy, I would say even more Burgundy than Bordeaux. Just these classic regions that absolutely make sense in this space in Midtown, which is an area that, let's see, how do I say this? I guess one of the things we're trying to do with the list is make the list fit the space and fit the neighborhood in New York.
What is the neighborhood? I have this idea that it's a lot of tourists and a lot of people who kind of work in the area. Is that accurate?
I think it's such a mix. Mm-hmm. It really is a mix. So yes, that is accurate. There are a lot of tourists. There are a lot of people who work in the neighborhood. And then there are also people who live not too far. So even in sort of a little bit west, Midtown West. Mm-hmm. So a lot of those, that's right.
I guess I know a lot of people who live in that kind of northern Hell's Kitchen, mm-hmm. Midtown West area.
Exactly.
I didn't think about that. That is super close.
And Mopesh is in the Chambers Hotel. So there are a lot of hotel guests who come down and, mm-hmm. and will have breakfast, lunch, and dinner there.
So tell us a little bit about what your job is like. How do you function? How do you work? What are you doing? What are your weeks like? What are your days like?
Okay, so they're always different, but the structure that I've sort of have in place right now is that on Mondays and Fridays, those are sort of the downtown days. So every morning I go to the office, which is Union Square South, and it's great. So it's not far from where I live, and I can walk to work, and it's beautiful. And then I'm there during the day. And then on Mondays and Fridays, I go to Sambar and Noodle Bar, and we do pre-service there. And for me, pre-service is such an important part of a restaurant, right? That's like where the inspiration and the energy for the night comes from. So on Mondays and Fridays, sort of benchmarking or I guess bookending the week, I go first to Sambar and then right immediately afterwards to Noodle Bar for pre-service, and then I go back to the office. Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Saturday are more about Mopesh. So mornings, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday at the office, and then I just go right uptown. And then I try to be on the floor for service for those nights.
So you have a you're a 6-day work week.
It's like five. You know how it is. You know, some days it's five, some days it's seven. It's all good.
It's all good. I mean, that's just part. It's part of the restaurant totally. Industry. You never know what's gonna happen.
Exactly.
Dude. Well, tell us also a little bit about this very exciting Bellis project that you guys have. I saw you released a white wine from Burgundy. Which I have not had a chance to taste yet.
Oh, I should
yet.
Have brought that instead and, of...
I see you did bring a lovely wine, which I'm excited to taste. I am quite familiar with your red, which we've had, I guess, in two vintages now.
And thank you so much for being an amazing supporter of Bellis.
Yeah, it's our honor. It's nice to have something that is delicious, to support someone who I really like in the industry, but also support a really good... a really good cause. So tell us about how that project came about, how you and the Tory Burch Foundation came together. I wish there were more wines that kind of partnered. It seems to make a lot of sense. Please.
Okay. How did this start? So the white wine was actually a wine. All right. So it's a wine made from Burgundy, like you were saying, and I make it with Alix de Monti, and she has been a friend and a mentor since I was back in the kitchen. I met her right after.
Yeah, I forgot to mention, you've been to like every winery that I want to go to in the world, pretty much. So I'm going to be picking your brain about what it's like to visit Chave and Solos and all these great guys you've been to.
It's, you know, I think that's, for me, it's so helpful when you're on the floor and then, you know, somebody's saying, yeah, I you're the same way. You know, it's good to have a reference point. So I feel really lucky that I've been able to visit those places. But with Alix, she gave me... All right, so Alix, just to rewind a little bit, she also started in the kitchen. So she had worked at Pierre Garnier and a few other great restaurants. And then she got back into winemaking. And her family's been making wine since before the French Revolution. But they always made red wine. And her palate, she loves acidity. She loves purity. She loves focus. And Jean-Marc Rouleau, who is her husband, really inspired her to start making white wine. And really taught her a lot about that along the way. But she said to me, As I was coming out of the kitchen and interested in going to Burgundy, she said, let me know if I can ever help you. I feel that we have a connection, and if I can ever be of assistance, then let me know. And so I worked Harvest with her in 2007. And then, I've just always loved her style of wine, and then we've become close friends throughout the years. And so we had the Bellis Red, the Girasole, and it was a natural... I think a natural sort of friendship. It was a wine that was born out of friendship. So we blend two parcels. So we blend a parcel of wine from Pouligny-Montrachet and one from Merceau. We just made 216 cases. And it's called Les Roches Sœurs, which means the sister rock. And actually, mm-hmm. Becky Wasserman is the one who who helped me come up with the name. She said, "Well, what are you trying to get at?" And I said, "Well, you know, terroir, and you know, there's the mother rock of Burgundy." And she said, "What about Le Roche Sur instead of La Roche-Mère?" And Alixa's nickname for me had always been Ma Petite Sœur, so it worked out.
My little sister. I love that. So is that the key to making a good, for a sommelier who lives in New York, to make a good wine, you have to have someone like Alix to oversee the process? How do you guys work together with, is there a series of tasting, or you're like, Alix, this is what I want. You're a total badass. I'm sure you can get it done.
And I like to be over there for harvest. I feel like you learn about the vintage, you learn about the wine if you're actually there for the harvest. So I think that's one thing that is really helpful. But of course, in New York, it's not always possible because you can't always plan for it. So up until actually, so the Bellis Roseur is the 2011 vintage, and 2011 was the first time ever since 2006 that I had not been there for the harvest. So she and I were just on the phone like a few times a day, and then after Crown was open, so I couldn't leave because I was opening Crown, and then after Crown was open, that's when I was able to go back for the various other decisions. So the fining and all of these other little decisions, those were decisions that we made together.
Yeah. And you referenced about how you were previously working in the kitchen and you decided at some point to make that switch to front of house. How did that happen?
That happened, okay, so that happened really at the La Palais, La Palais de Neige, which was in Aspen. It was the first year that Daniel Jonas decided to do a smaller mini La Palais in Colorado. And it was, so I'm from Colorado, and I was going home anyway. And I asked if I could sort of get myself there, if he wouldn't mind having somebody else to help along the way. And he said, sure, that's fine. That's absolutely fine. And it was being there and being surrounded by these winemakers. So that it was a small handful. I think it was, Christophe Rumet and Dominique Lafon and Jean-Marc Rouleau, Alix de Monti, Jean-Pierre de Smet, and I think Pascal Marchand was the final one. But being there and trying these wines and getting to cook with Danielle and just seeing his eyes light up and just sort of being in this moment, which felt so surreal. It was also this moment that made me realize that wine was so much more than a delicious substance in a glass. And I knew that anyway, but I guess it was such an emotionally compelling moment that I knew that I wanted to figure out some way to live that world or to have that world as...
Yeah, I can't imagine how like being in Aspen with some of the greatest winemakers in the entire world, drinking wine and hanging out and laughing with the mountains in the background. Like, I can't imagine how you weren't craving to be in like the flames and heat and fluorescent lights of the kitchen at that time.
I was also so scared because that was this moment like, what am I doing? How did I get into this moment right here? But this is a moment that is so amazing that I have to do everything I can.
I want to replicate this. I want this to happen more times in my life.
Exactly.
Yeah, I've done the Palais several times now, and I am still very scared every time.
Well, and that was the Palais where, like, you know, I was cooking, chicken oysters? I didn't have to do any wine service. That was way too foreign, but this was just Danielle, and then the chef de cuisine at DB Bistro Moderne at the time was Olivier, and he was from Alsace, and so he would make these tart flambés, but he also had this amazing frog's leg and chicken oyster recipe. So, like, the only part of the chicken we used for this entire weekend was the chicken oyster.
So, what do they do with the rest of the chicken?
I'm sure they found a good use for that.
Okay, I'm sure they did. Tell us about the chicken oyster. I love chicken oysters.
Oh, I love the chicken oyster. Okay, so the chicken oyster is this little tiny morsel of dark meat that sort of nests below or behind. Like if you're carving a chicken, it's sort of underneath the thigh.
Yeah.
But it's hard to find. I didn't know it existed until I was...
You gotta be good.
Yes.
It's like if chicken had a foie gras, that would be it. You can usually get it at yakitori restaurants.
Ooh, yum.
And so delicious. Yakitori Toto, close to you. If you haven't been yet...
I've never been.
You must you must go.
Okay.
It is absolutely delicious. And usually yakitori restaurants are predominantly chicken, and they do very small cuts of various different chicken parts, chicken oyster being most of them. But yakitori toto has a little bit more of a varied selection as well. But that is one of my absolute favorite things to get there. Okay, so we're going to take just a quick break, or we'll be back, and we're going to be talking with Jordan Salcido, the beverage operations director, manager of the Momofuku Group, and my really good friend. So we'll be back after a short break.
Brooklyn Slate Company is a collaborative effort from Brooklyn graphic designer Sean Tice and Parsons graduate student Christy Hedeka. After visiting Christie's family slate quarry in upstate New York in the spring of 2009, the two grabbed a few pieces for use as all-purpose boards back home in Brooklyn. They found a number of purposes for the slate and began gifting pieces to friends. The response was so overwhelmingly positive that the two struck out to produce a line of slate products. They now make regular trips to the family quarry in upstate New York to hand-pick their favorite pieces of black and red slate. Some of the slate is sourced from the quarry graveyard, a collection of odd-shaped pieces that were ultimately destined to be ground for use as road cover or baseball diamonds. They then transport the pieces to their studio in Red Hook, Brooklyn, where they do additional cutting and clean the stone to be food slate. Every single piece of packaging that comes with their products, from the envelope to the burlap bag, can be repurposed for other uses. The end result is a product completely unique in cut, shape, color, and overall presentation. For more information and to order, visit brooklynslate.com.
We're back on In the Drink on heritageradionetwork.org. I'm here with Jordan Salcido, the beverage director for the Momofuku Group, and my good friend, one of the nicest people in the industry, by the way. I've never heard Jordan say anything less than nice about anyone or any place or anything in the world. Do you have a mean bone in your body? Can you bring it? Can you say that, oh, my meal at that place was mediocre? Like, are you able to do that? You're like the nicest person I've ever met.
Joe, you are the sweetest person that I've ever met. So I feel like, I don't know, I'm inspired by yours. You really are. I could say exactly the same thing about you. So thank you so much. That's an amazing compliment.
Thank you, Jordan. I want to ask you, I'm also... I consider myself to be friends with your husband as well, Robert Bohr, who is a force in the industry.
He is.
He has his hands in lots and lots of things. But I guess I deal with him mostly also on a professional level with Grand Cru imports. We buy lots of wine from Grand Cru, including Bellis, but Arpepe, some Giacomo Quinterno wines, all sorts of really amazing wines. And if I had the ability to buy very nice Burgundy, I would be doing that as well. But what is it like to be in a house with two wine professionals?
You know, I think there are. It's mostly awesome. I think the thing that's really great is that we both share the same passion. So, and also we're both coming at it from different viewpoints. Robert was for sure the earliest mentor that I had in the wine world. I mean, I met him really early on, and then and then when we were dating, I got to drink all these crazy wines because he was at Crew at the time, and so that part is amazing. And then I think. And then I sort of bring a different perspective. So the two of us together, I think, have a much better view of wine, or at least a more complete view of a lot of wines than we would otherwise. But yeah, no, I think we also have slightly different palates. Like he would never say he doesn't love Riesling, and I don't understand how somebody couldn't love Riesling as much as I do. And he likes a lot of these herbaceous Italian white wines that don't compel me as much. And so I think it's great from that standpoint too, because it's not like, I mean, I think that I know my own palate now, and he knows his own palate. And so I think it reaffirms that there isn't good wine or bad wine, and that you've arrived when you recognize that this wine is a delicious wine. No, that's always a subjective thing. So I think we learn a lot from each other.
Would you say that the Riesling thing is the thing that you guys disagree on the very most when it comes to your wine preferences?
It's so funny. I might have said Corsican wines last year, but if you go to the list at Charlie Bird, it's full of Corsican wines. I was giving him a hard time about it last night. because he used to give me a hard time about Corsican wines, like Corsica. And of course, he loves Corsican wine.
Now he loves. Oh, how could you not love Abatucci's wine?
I know, and they have an amazing selection of Abatucci at Charlie Bird, and Antoine Arena, and a lot of good stuff.
Okay, I definitely need to explore the rest of Corsica. I know a couple of producers, and sometimes we have them at Amphora. Mm. But the best that I've had are these Abatucci wines, and if there could be wine that's that good, then you know that there are other people who have to be doing interesting things as well.
So this is completely off topic, but yeah. You were just talking about Amphora, and I had an amazing meal at La Piccio the other night. And I just want to say thank you, because your lists are always, they always push boundaries in a way that's welcoming and friendly. And I think that that's awesome. So thank you for that.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate that. Yeah, I mean, for me, like, one of the most exciting things about wine, and one of the reasons I love tasting wine with you is that I know you share this, is the discovery aspect. I've seen your eyes light up many, many times when discovering some, whether it's a new wine or a new fact about wine, or even hearing someone else's opinion that you didn't think of something in that kind of way. You have that, you get extremely excited to hear about something new, a new perspective in wine. And so for me, wine, the discovery aspect is kind of the most exciting thing. And that's why I try to push those boundaries a little bit, try to introduce people to something that is new that maybe they haven't had before, or look at wine in a way that they haven't thought of.
100%, because we are part of their journey, or in the same way that we get to go on these journeys when we learn new things about wine or new wines. Exactly. I couldn't agree more.
Speaking of journeys, what a great segue. You've recently been to France and you brought back a lovely bottle of wine for us to taste.
I did. All right. So I get to go to France at least a couple times a year, which is awesome. And this was the first time that I went, and I rented a car by myself for a few days, and I just drove around to visit regions and producers that I hadn't been to before. And so one of my dreams was to go visit Domaine Pierre Gonon. And actually, that was the first visit. That was my very first visit this trip. So I tasted with Jean Gonon, and it's two brothers, Pierre and Jean, and I've never met Pierre, but Jean, you would love him, and he would love you. He is the happiest person. My flight was 5 hours delayed. So I get in, and I call him, or I send him a note, thinking probably he's not going to be checking email, but certainly if he does, he's going to cancel this appointment, because who wants to wait around for somebody he's never met? Anyway, but he wrote right back, said, "Don't worry, take your time," and I got there, and the cellar is, so he's in the town of Mauve, a little tiny village in Saint-Joseph, which is one of the original six villages that were classified as Saint-Joseph before the appellation grew, and before the government mandated that the appellation grow. And he makes a few different wines. The one that we're drinking now is his white wine, Les Oliviers. So he makes two white wines. One is Old Vine Chasselas, which is beautiful. And then this one is, it's grown on a steep parcel, but where the gravel or the soil is quite complex. So it's decomposing granite, and it's also loess and argile calcaire. And one of the things that impressed me most was just how mineral these wines are, and how he's able to translate this perception of brightness in a wine made from grapes that aren't really about acidity. So this is 60% Marsan, 40% Roussan.
Normally you'd expect a Rhone Valley white wine to certainly be a little bit more plump and round and alcoholic, and not have this kind of like definition and clarity. And this is just, it's so, so pretty. Also, I'm impressed by Jordan. You take amazing notes. We've done tasting groups together. I've seen you at tastings before. Always the student, always taking incredible, incredible notes. I feel like that's very impressive, because there's no way, like, I would go and visit the estate, and I'd stop at the point where he was a really great guy, you'd really like him, and they make really good wine, you know?
I think it's because I can't trust my memory anymore. I'm getting very old, Joe, so I have to rely on facts that I actually write down that I can trust later on.
And it serves you well, because, yeah, I mean, you're able to, after you've written down those facts, you're able to, I guess, store them a lot better than me.
I think for me, I know that I would get them wrong. And so it's just, or just that repetition. And I think, I don't know, maybe it's because it's probably started with like, I don't know, my writing background. I don't know. I think I just remember things better if I write them down.
Well, tell us about your writing background. I didn't know that about you.
Oh, that was what I thought I wanted to do in life, was write. And so I still write sometimes. But no, I got into culinary school because I was writing for a newspaper in Colorado and a magazine in Colorado. And then I thought that if I wanted to be a serious writer about food, then I should really understand food. And so I should go to culinary school and I should cook at a French restaurant that really was all about food. And then it was during that time that I was sort of, you know, you get to spend time and like see Danielle Boulud all day long, just, you know, so dynamic and so generous with his time and with his spirit. And the more that I spent time in the industry, the more I was like, wait a minute, I don't want to leave this. This is amazing. I can't do this later on, and maybe there might be, hopefully, sometime where I might be able to write later on. But there was a small moment, and it was I won't go into that. But yeah, no, you sometimes have these little signs from the universe, and I had a couple of those, and mm-hmm. they said, hey, stick with this for now. This is a good thing.
Yeah, and there was something else that you touched on that I feel very strongly about, is that if you are going to convey a fact to a guest or to your staff, it better be a truthful,
yes.
Better be the right fact.
Yes.
And so whether it's that your memory doesn't serve you right or you didn't know the right thing, I do think that we have a responsibility at least to make sure that what we're saying is accurate. And by taking those good notes, by visiting the estates, a lot of times you can't trust what you see. I mean, I can't tell you how many times I've seen some information online and then visited the estate. Like, but on the website, it said this for so long. You don't do it like that. That's not how it happens.
Like, we outsource that to our intern.
Yeah, that's not how that happens.
Oh, yes. No, I agree with that. I mean, I think that is part of our job. That our job is to bring to light in the most honest way the experience of the experience and the information surrounding the wine that we're serving to our guests.
Now, I just want a little bit more winery visit porn. Just tell me, like, what are some of your best visits?
Oh, my goodness. Oh, wow. Okay. All right. So, one that's so obvious is Comte Ligier Belair, yes, in Vaughan Romanée. He is a riot. He is just hilarious, and I love his wines. I'm obsessed with them.
Pink pants, he always wears.
Pink pants, yes. Totally. So I got to work Harvest with him in 2010, and he does this brilliant thing. He hires, first of all, his entire family and extended family and his wife's family. They all come down from all over. His wife's family is in the Loire, so they all come down, and then he hires 80 pickers. So basically, they just get the job done in a weekend. It's the most impressive thing. And he comes from this lineage of soldiers. So there were soldiers of, like, his great-grandfather or great-great-great-grandfather was in the Napoleon's army, and then the soldier, like, his father was in, you know, part of the court of, like, Louis the 16th, I guess. Anyway.
One was an ancient Roman warrior, and an Etruscan.
Exactly. So his nickname is the General, but he's just amazing, and I love his wines, and I love the way he talks about wine. But he also has these hysterical analogies. So when he's talking to people about Burgundy and trying to explain, like, the slopes of Burgundy, he compares it to a sandwich. So he says, like, you know, because, like, the slope of Burgundy is sort of like, it's like the, you know, it's all one slope, basically, that runs north to south, generally speaking. And he says, okay, the reason why the Grand Crus are all in the middle is because that's the perfect, you know, the combination of soil, of the clay, the calcareous clay, and also the limestone. So that's in the middle, that's like your meat. And then the Premier Cru are just above and below that. That's where there's either like a little too much soil or a little too much clay. And those are the cheese slices. And then the Village is up at the top or down at the very bottom. And that's the bread. So that's one of my favorite Louis-Michel Ligier Belair analogies. That's great. Solos was an amazing visit. I visited, this one isn't so, maybe this one's just exciting to me because I'd never been to the Savoie, but I went to go visit Patrick Botex. I love that bougie Sirloin. I've tasted them all, and that's the one I like the best. And I went to visit, and he was so surprised, because I guess nobody ever goes to visit him, because it's too far away, and it's not that far away. But he had this tart au praliné, and, like, he brought his wife down and his little son. I was, like, the spectacle, because I had come to visit from New York, and he lives in a town that used to have 1,000 people, and now it has 30 people, and there's a village oven, and it's just beautiful.
So what advice do you give to your guests who maybe aren't in the industry and want to go do one of these visits? I'm sure you know, you're a client, you buy these wines, you know a lot of these people for years, but if you're someone who's a guest...
Yes. Okay, so I guess, like with anything, I try to tailor the experience. So if it's somebody who's a guest and they're just getting into wine, or they're going to Burgundy but with their whole family or whatever, then I always recommend going actually to see one of the larger producers, one of the larger négociants like Domaine Drouin or Louis Jadot or even Bouchard. More Jadot and Drouin, but you know, you go and that's where you have this amazing snapshot of the entire coat. And I think that that's really helpful. And then, you know, if maybe it's somebody who's been collecting wine for a long time, and if I can help with like a producer that they've never been able to visit, then that's such a joy to be able to help them in that way. And I think, you know, it just, you want to tailor it depending on the experience of that would best serve that person.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I think that it makes sense to befriend your sommelier as well. Go back, visit a few times. If there is a place that you really like the wine list, make friends with the person who's putting together that list. And then when you do go, like, I feel if one of our guests is going to visit a wine region and they're a good, loyal guest, I'm going to get in touch with our reps and
take care
of them, hook it up.
100%.
So I'd say it is worth your time to befriend your sommelier. But that, I really like that advice about going to the larger producers first if you haven't spent much time there. To kind of get, because a lot of those producers will make wines in many different appellations,
yes,
and they'll have more resources, yes, in order to be able to spend more time to show you around a little bit more, as opposed to a small family who they're working all the time.
Exactly. Yeah. And the small family who's working all the time might have 3 or 4 different wines, but that represent 3 or 4 different vineyards in various appellations, but when you can see the whole spectrum, mm-hmm, I think you have such a large control group that you really get a sense of a vintage or a village or other factors in addition to the producer itself.
I'm still loving this Ganon Saint-Joseph Blanc. It is delicious. Is this available in New York, by the way? Can people get this?
It is available. I know Chamber Street always has some.
Okay.
Actually, I should know. Chamber Street does not always have some. For example, they don't have any right now when I called them for more. But they do.
From time to time, Carrie.
From time to time.
It is so good. Jordan, what do you have coming up in the next few months? You have it?
Okay, what do we have coming up in the next few months? We're working on a new Bellis project, a new wine that is a Bellis wine, but from the United States. So I'm really excited about that, but I don't want to talk about it yet because we're still nailing down a couple of details, but super excited about that. And then I want to say just what we're doing with Momofuku. It's a group that I love being part of because things are always evolving and they're always innovating and they're always changing. So
one of the most exciting groups to be part of, and the quality, the approachability. I'm going to be at one of these Mopesh large format dinners.
I can't wait.
Absolutely. How do you find out about when they're coming up and what's going on?
Oh, you just book one.
Okay.
You go online to the website.
You can book it any night of the week.
You can book it any night of the week. Exactly.
Oh, it's going down. It's happening.
I can't wait.
Thank you so much, Jordan Salcido of Momofuku, of Bellis, and partner in Charlie Bird, which is awesome. You guys should definitely check it out. This has been In the Drink on heritageradionetwork.org.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.